Hey, 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 boys. Look what I've got here.
Ooh. I'll put it away, Doc, not while we're working.
Oh, come on, boys. It's only a bit of tomfoolery. Ooh, Mark. I do like long beards. Who's tapping?
Oh, sorry. That's John Barrowman tapping on my back. Doc, I think that you do encourage an overly relaxed and at times unprofessional culture on the podcast.
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 148 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there, or as it's becoming known, the long path back to knowledge. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Mark.
Oh, what's that?
Good God. Strophon nearly had a heart attack.
Broken that glass dome. What's this that's landed on the marble floor of the atrium?
Not only that, but it's landed on the soothsayer as well.
Have we got budget for this?
So doeth the soothsayer. I leave you with these words. Friends, Romans.
Countrymen.
I know, what's the use?
It's a crate. What's that say it's on the side of it, hidden?
I don't know, it's the wrong... Hang on, let me turn my head a bit. This way up.
Sorry, it doesn't say Issy Noho, use no hooks. I'm showing my age there, aren't I? Why would someone put a crate upside down? Get your crowbar out, Mark.
Hold on.
Has he got a Swiss Army knife with a crowbar on it?
Why? If it isn't...
That isn't, is it?
If it isn't friend of the show... the other Mark.
Another Mark? Not another one.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody.
There you go. Let me help you. There you go.
Oh, that's much better.
It's Mark from the 42 to Doomsday podcast. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
I didn't think you'd come in this way. There is a doorbell, you know.
Nah, we've never used a doorbell.
Maybe he got sucked out of the sky by big woodlice living under the museum.
Well, there's plenty of woodlice in the crate with me, wasn't there? You know, all waggling their arms about profusely and doing strange Kate Bush dances with me to keep me occupied during the long travel over here. And of course, I had to spend an extra 14 days in quarantine.
Oh, that was true. Yeah.
Mark is one of the several guests that, this is really going to be complicated, that our Mark, who have decided to call for the purposes of this episode, Permanent Marker, and I dragged in to record podcast with us because we thought that Hayden's paternity leave was going to last for several months. But it turned out it didn't. And Hayden's just as anxious as ever to get a rest from the angelic squalling of his new son. So, what's been happening since last week? In fact, when did we last encounter you, Mark? Let's have a look.
It was a while back now. It was with, I think it was when we were on our hiatus, I think it was. And then, yes. And
that doesn't exactly narrow it down, does it? You have so many hiatuses.
I've got a feeling that it wasn't long after our 100th episode.
The thing is, I was going into the records. I can't search for Mark, can I?
No. Temporary marker.
As our Mark, you Mark, Mark Cochran, or at least Mark from the... Proctor Who podcast has the decency to spell his name wrongly. Let's see.
At least when our Marks come to the Whoseum as guests, at least we get to spend, save a little bit of money on the lanyards that we hand out to guests.
When we recorded with Mark and Rob, I think it would that have been 2017?
It was just after the 100th episode.
2018.
It's been a long time.
We might have been plugging Rob's book, so Candy might work.
Yes, he's still working on the book, hence he's not here. I've been giving him some suggestions to help him through it, like, because he's writing, obviously, about the Brigadier. And I said, what about coming up with a storyline where we've got one Brigadier who has this awesome power to regenerate. You keep killing it. And then all these other Brigadiers turn up. But he said, that'd be ridiculous, Mark.
Episode 101. It's 101.
Could it be as long ago as 2016?
No.
I will repeat what I said. It's episode 101.
Was it?
Yeah.
Were you reproving me there?
It was just after. Well, I've been saying for the like 20 the minutes. Last 5 minutes.
It was like, who's this fourth guy on the podcast? Can't be Hayden. He's on paternity leave.
And you could tell his tolerance level.
It was episode 101, 42 to Whom's Day.
Of course.
Which went out on the 6th of October 2018 and just had Doc Mark and Robin Mark from 42 to Doomsday. I've got the spreadsheet open.
If I only I didn't think of such witty episode titles, I'd be able to remember who... if I just put Robin Mark turn up.
Ah, speaking of which,
yes.
I was listening to bits of our back catalogue recently. And the episode when we were talking about conventions was called Conventionality Belongs to Yesterday.
That was clever.
I finally got that 5 years on. I thought, oh, I know what that's from.
About conventions being a thing of the past.
Yeah, not as good as...
I don't feel so bad now because I also occasionally go back into our back catalogue. And I just noticed that earlier on we were quite serious and less ranty, where now it's full-throated ranty desk thumping. And that's just the opening 3 seconds.
To be honest, Mark, that's really poor to talk about full-throated, considering what we're going to talk about.
Yes.
I'm going to have a private word with you, Hayden, about our numbers on appearances. Because during a bored afternoon when I was trying to put other things together,
mm-hmm.
I totted them up, and I'm sure that ours clash. We've still got to decide whether a full appearance counts as turning up for the recording,
or whether it
counts if you just post along a recorded insert to stick in.
Well, obviously, as someone who's not missed a recording since he started, I would say that only turning up for the recording counts.
Well, you're doing well, mate. I've let the team down on numerous occasions. Rob's only missed one during our duration. I've missed a few, though, due to not being available or...
About 15 more for Mark before he hits 100. About 10 more for me to hit 150. Hayden's just around about 103, I think.
I'm on 100 and... Do you know what? That all tallies up, actually, with what I've got. What you just said just then.
And, Doc, we actually had you on one of our episodes as well, actually.
That was a happy time, wasn't it?
It was. And we also were very witty with the title. We called it Doc Whom Is Required.
I remember having to lie down with a damp towel on my forehead because I was laughing so hard. I just remember that mainly consisted of us talking about ITV franchises, didn't it? And regional accents.
Oh, yes. Episode 52 it was. Gosh, we were so young. 2016.
We had Mr. Kitchen on the other day recently, and he said to us... We broadcast that, yes, we have, haven't we?
Yes, it's gone out. I've listened to it, it's very good.
We know we broadcast that because my mother listens to it at night. And she said to me, I only really got halfway through. I'm only really interested in you and Hayden and Mark chatting to each other. I quite enjoy it. When you actually get on to talk about Doctor Who, I sort of. What did we talk about in episode 101 in October 2018?
We talked about an issue of DWM that had a story by a certain Robin there called Roses?
Roses, didn't we? Yes.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes. Used to bring me roses. I wish you would again.
Again. But that was on the outside. And things are different then.
I actually live a 10-minute drive away from where that was shot. Not literally shot, but filmed. Yes.
Dark Circus fanzine, what was that?
That's an Australian fanzine in the late 80s. I think Kate Orman put that together, or was it some other guy? I can't remember. But yeah, Rob loves his Australian fanzines. But I do remember Dark Circus was quite good.
Rob, of course, is Mark's companion on... Let me rephrase that. Rob, of course, is Mark's colleague on the 42 to Doomsday podcast. Oh, yes, that's right. We were talking about him recovering the power of the Daleks clips, didn't we?
Yes.
Serial killers in Adelaide.
Yes. Yes, we're big into that as well. Yeah, it's always... We're like dogs eating our own sick occasionally, which is quite ironic given what's going on in my house at the moment. We go back to Power of the Daleks and serial killers in South Australia.
Is it possible he could return a little bit more, please?
Stay tuned.
Don Dunstan in pink shorts.
He was the South Australian premier in the 80s. And I think we also mentioned that there was a neighbour's computer game doc, and I put the link of the YouTube clip on our blog when we released the episode. And you were completely, you know, flummoxed by it. Well, more than normal after the conversation, but yes, on the old Commodore 64.
Yes, I remember. I don't think I ever had a Commodore. I ended up with a bit, maybe I did. I can't remember that long ago.
It was only 2 weeks ago.
So what have you been doing in the last 2.5 years?
What have I been doing for the last 2 years? Well, we sort of said we're stopping the podcast and then we started it back up again. And we just keep releasing them when we feel like it, which seems to be monthly at the moment.
Mm.
I've had 5 jobs since then. What else has happened? My hair's gone greyer.
I do like that bit you do on the podcast where you go through old Doctor Who fanzines from the 80s.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it. Yeah, it's a pretty novel concept, isn't it, really? I've been doing that since 2014. Yeah.
We were mulling over the idea not so long ago of doing a podcast somehow related to, you know how you'd be able to sometimes do things like, oh, the, Genesis of the Daleks, the original name was, what do they call those?
A working title.
Working title thing. Working names for podcasts. Now, did you seriously consider doing Doable Barkers?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that would have been a great name.
Yeah, when we set it up, and I said, let's go with this name. And, of course, it was just when the Marsden book came out. So it hadn't really kicked off then by, you know, the press sort of getting onto the whole stuff that they did eventually. So we changed it to, oh, we're 42. And the thing is, we're rapidly coming up to 50. So either we change the name to something else or we just keep going, you know, just keep dyeing my hair like Rudy Giuliani. I don't know.
You're on the lower side of 50, are you? Thanks for pointing that out.
I'm 49. I'm turning 50 end of the year. 2 days after Christmas.
The boys came up with this, and I spent about an hour one afternoon going back through Facebook, back, until about early January 2014 to try to find our original discussion about what things were going. It seems to be mostly about logos. We did have an idea, I think... I thought at one point that analog time would be a really, really witty remark, sort of, you know, sort of a battered, old-fashioned way of looking at things. And I think at one stage I suggested we called it the Clockwork Rocket Ship, which I think is both a line from The Womble of the Universe and is also a sci-fi novel by an Australian sci-fi writer, I think.
Was it Robert Moen, the Australian sci-fi writer?
No, I think his name's Egan or something. Yeah, no, it's someone called Greg Egan, I think. As I flew my clockwork rocket ship, I listened to the radio. Even though it was a clockwork rocket ship, they were speaking to me from below.
We've got 2 lost episodes of... So basically, Rob and I did a pilot episode where we're just trying to work out the equipment and everything like that. And then we did like a 2.5-hour review of the J&T book when it just came out. And then I realised that I actually hadn't switched over to the Blue Snowball microphone. So I was just recording off my PC mic and it sounded pretty So we basically went back and redid it. It was a lot tighter, obviously. But yeah, I've still got that somewhere. I should release it as an After Dark, maybe. I don't know.
We had one very, very early podcast when Al No was doing all the editing where he something went wrong at his end. And so he went through the entire recorded podcast, re-recording his lines.
In other words,
leaving a space and then repeating that as very desperately sad. Anyway, I think the Rev eventually came up with Diddly Dum. Partly one way, because I think it's just with 6 2 words, 6 and 3, it fitted in with all the Doctor Who logos. So there we are.
It's a great name.
Has anything been happening in Doctor Who news in the last few weeks? Anything, anything non-libelous?
And on to our next topic.
I do think that whenever the lawyers get involved, you start experiencing words which you never hear in any other format, such as exuberant on-set behaviour.
Yes.
And tomfoolery. And do you ever hear the word vehemently in any other context than just before the word did I?
Mm. To be honest with you, I'm surprised that it's taken this long for these allegations to come out, because I was a little bit shocked with regards to the whole Noel Clarke story, actually. But I think there's been an awful lot of commentary, especially on Twitter recently, with people saying, oh, well, this is why Eccleston left after one series. Good on him, because he saw this kind of stuff going on. And I kind of think, well,
yes,
actually, if we really were to champion Christopher Eccleston in this moment, surely he would have made complaints at that point that would have had to have been acted upon.
I heard a rumour. I don't think we should go into this too much, because we don't want to be...
No.
It's not particularly nice to talk about that. And it says the man who's just brought it to jump in the first place.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
And it's not fair on other people, but I think just more to look at it more at the idea of fan reactions to things. We could be like the broadsheet newspapers. We won't actually gossip about Big Brother, but we will talk about it as a cultural phenomenon. I did hear a few years ago someone saying that Chris Eccleston didn't get on that well with John Barrowman while they were on set because of him doing things like that. You know, being silly on set and doing that sort of thing. But
It's not just on TV, though, apparently. I know people. I've worked in theatre. I know other people.
Oh, my God. Where is this going?
Friends and family who work in the theatre. And John Barrowman was very much the same. It was just kind of what he did. And he was the same in the theatre. It's just a pattern of behaviour that he was doing all the time.
Which, and this is something which I really don't like, is the fact that his sexuality is used as a get-out-of-jail-free card with it, which is just appalling.
Mm.
And I'm afraid this is the third time now that an ex-Doctor Who star has basically been found out to be, unfortunately, like this. And they all stem from that first series. And I do feel that there was perhaps an issue with regards to the recruitment at the start, and of course you do trace that back to Julie Gardner, Phil Collinson, Russell T Davis and Andy Pryor, the casting director. I mean, they would have known about this kind of stuff. I think I saw somewhere, I think it was a Guardian thing recently, that said that Julie Gardner had reprimanded John Barrowman after he'd done something on the set of Torchwood. And after that, he sort of changed his behaviour. But, I mean, these people were employed. They didn't have to be. They could have been written out or, you know, but they let this stuff happen. And they really need to take a look at themselves for that, I think.
I was going to say, I think there's been a culture of that, though, throughout the entertainment industry anyway, especially of big stars. I mean, certainly, you look at all the bands that we listen to these days, you know, from the 70s, the 60s and stuff. I mean, their behaviour is absolutely reprehensible, you know. Yeah, there's culture in the entertainment industry. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but there's a theatre company, which there's a big star who goes there, and the theatre company put a memo out to say women shouldn't get in the lift with this guy because...
Yes, you don't remember telling us about that.
He will grope you. And that's their way of dealing with it, because the guy's a big star. And rather than say, do you know what, you sod off, we're not using you, or you can't, we're not having your production here, they've just had to send out memos for women to avoid him, which is
awful.
It's extraordinary.
And that's fairly recently.
And apparently Mark went to these producers and says, I do not.
Well, I can tell you, off the record, obviously, I can say to Mark who it is, if you're interested.
Absolutely. Go on. Spill the tea. Really?
Yeah.
But with that sort of thing, you'd think, if it ever happens that, you know, someone suddenly decides they've had enough and it comes out, you know, 15 women have complained and it turns out that the producers put this sign up in the lift.
Wow.
It clearly means that they knew all about
it.
Absolutely.
You thought they'd be in trouble, wouldn't you?
Well, but, yeah, We just had Craig McLaughlin over here, you know, because he got accused as of harassment.
Was he Harry in Neighbours? Was that it?
Yes, he was, and he's you know, the touring Frankenfurter for the Rocky Horror Picture Show. He's been doing it for years. He's supposed to be very good about it, but these allegations came out of sort of inappropriate behaviour on the set. And look, he got acquitted, but still, you know, his reputation's in tatters. But I just don't understand, like, Barrowman is how old? And he's still acting like a 13-year-old. Yeah, and you know, if we got our todgers out at work and started doing that, we'll be instant dismissal, you know?
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, though, is Barrowman's behaviour, did that get back to Moffat, and that's why he never used him during his tenure on the programme?
Well, possibly.
I did hear that apparently he was filming, I think it was Miracle Day, at the same time as A Good Man Goes to War was in production, and he did want to use him in that sort of gang, the Paternoster gang and all that kind of stuff. But that was kind of spoken about at the time.
Right.
I don't know. I think Mark's right about the whole culture issue, and it's difficult to change a culture, but I think these people have to take a good, long, hard look at themselves, irregardless of there being a culture or not.
I have to say that when I was at uni, spins a web any size. So you end up with a blister on it. Anyway, that's certainly not going out. What I was going to say was, who are these other two people from the first year?
It was Noel Clarke, John Barrowman, and Bruno Langley.
Oh, that's right. Langley was, yes,
oh,
that's
I didn't
right.
realise. Mm. Yeah. Right.
Didn't he get sacked off Coronation Street or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yes, he did, yeah.
Well, from what I've heard from, I think, partly from someone I know, and that was just as much about the fact that catch your seats, just like flies, look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood, can he swing from a thread? And that's why they said, we won't renew your contract. And he ended up, I think he ended up... Take a look overhead,
hey there.
Mind you, we've all done that. My God, how much of that can I actually broadcast?
About 3 minutes of it. But I was actually going to ask you guys, you know how they just redone that Doctor Who Fracture in Time thing, and Captain Jack does feature in that. Are they going to keep Captain Jack in it?
What's this? Is this Big Finish?
No, it's some sort of, isn't it some sort of cinema experience or something like that?
It's an interactive thing, yeah.
Yeah, they've got, you know, David Bradley in again to really keep on Hartnell's legacy. And you've got Barrowman in there, so that's going to be interesting to see if they're going to edit that bit out.
The thing is, I don't think waving your dick around is that bad, really. I mean, you think more childish, don't you, rather than abusive. I mean, they did that to one of my favourite actors is, Australian actor. He was the pirate captain in
Geoffrey Rush.
Oh, and yeah. Apparently that happened to him as well. He was,
yes, that's right.
He was doing a sort of, should we say, a light-hearted flash on set. And he got, I think it's only one of those things that needs to be cut, if you'll excuse the expression, cut off early, isn't it? So that no one gets to think, oh, it's the, you know, it's acceptable way of doing things.
As I keep saying, if we all got our todgers out at work, we'd be sacked. And my view is he absolutely should be the same.
Yep.
You know, and I feel sorry for people, because you sort of read on Twitter, people, you know, obviously commenting about it, and they said, I can't watch Series 1 the same way again.
Yeah.
It's like when you hear a Michael Jackson song on the radio. Yeah, people are still going to play it and listen to it, so...
To be fair, I didn't particularly like Mickey that much in the first place. It's not
going
to affect
me that
much. No. And I don't think anyone is going to rewatch Series 1, look at John Barrowman and think... If only I'd suspected that he was like that all along.
Yeah.
I was just going to sing a song. Oh, Mickey, you are a perv, you are a perv, you show a lot of nerve. Hey, Mickey.
Tony Basil?
Yes. Tony Basil. Actually, no, originally. No, not originally. It was an Italian singer who did it originally, and then she covered it, and then got the worldwide hit. There you go. I bring my suppository of all knowledge comes through again for you guys.
I do think, you know how sometimes we do this thing about when someone new gets cast in the show, and we take the piss out of the stilted language of the press release. I am so happy to have joined the TARDIS family and have wonderful adventures with the Doctor through time and space.
Awful.
I think in the same way you can tell that a joyous reaction to being cast in Doctor Who has been written by the press office, you can also tell when an apology has been written by the lawyers.
Yes.
I vehemently deny. Recent reports, however, have made it clear to me. I will be seeking professional help to educate myself and change for the better. Has anything decent that wouldn't shock our mothers happened in the last few weeks in Doctor Who? I don't think it has it? No news about the filming or anything?
No.
Is it still going on, the series? Okay. I don't watch it. No, it's been... And here's the thing. It's just that this is a massive vacuum. It's been... Chibnall just locks everything down so much. It's just a massive vacuum where nothing... The only thing that sort of bubbles up is the bad stuff, really, isn't it? Or the occasional bit of merchant... I mean, the only sort of, silver lining's been the recent Season 8 box set. It's been... I've been sort of slowly working my way through that and obviously had a bit of a detour to talk about what we're going to talk about later on. But they're definitely the highlights for me. And I actually also got the Clack book from Candy Jar.
What's that like?
It's beautiful. It's really nice. Oh. Yeah, it's really what's well this? Put together. It's a book of all the Chris Achilleos paintings.
Oh, yes, I've heard about this.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, go and get it. It's very good. It's actually beautifully presented, really nice. Because I must admit, I read a lot of books and magazines on digital media now because I'm just a bit lazy, to be honest. But just having that beautiful sort of, tactile experience. Mm. I'm keeping it in my pants, guys, when I'm talking about this book. But it's a wonderful book. Yeah, really nice. Yeah. Beautiful, great print quality, and just the covers, those early covers is so... Yeah, Claws of Axos is still one of my favourite covers, and the Web of Fear that he did. And of course, let's all not forget the Clack.
No.
Right, well, I think we've already got on so far that if we don't want Sophie to be standing at the door tapping her watch meaningfully, I think we ought to get on to... We foolishly invite our recent guests to choose a story that we haven't reviewed before for us to review. And Mark chose for us Frontios.
I did.
Which I must confess, in our Peter Davison retrospective, I bigged up in a big way. Although when I heard this, we got to review this, so my heart did sink slightly. But it might have sunk further, or it might have risen even more after watching it earlier this afternoon. So, Frontios, directed by Ron Jones, I must admit he's a director I'm not that familiar with, written by none other than Christopher H. Bidmead, adding the logic.
Making it boring.
Making it boring. Directed
by Eric Saywood. It was series 21. Was this Davison's final series? It was, wasn't it?
Unfortunately, yes. It was. Well, unfortunately for us, but fortunately for him.
Broadcast January and February 1984.
Happy days.
Visiting Mark, you inflicted this on us. Why don't you start off with it?
Well, I know the reason I chose this is because I think, and I know we've talked about it a few times, Doc, you sort of lost the passion with the series by this. And obviously Hayden wasn't around then. Don't take it the wrong way, mate. And Mark, I can't remember if you were sort of slowly sinking out of love with the series.
Yeah.
A bit like what was happening in Frontios with the dead people. But yes. I just thought that I thought I'd challenge you guys a bit today and talk about Frontios, because the Davison years is when I essentially grew up with the program. I have vague memories of Tom Baker, and particularly his last season. But the Davison years is when I became a fan with a capital F, as it were, to the point that I'd go to school and talk to people who also liked Doctor Who. And by the end of the conversation, they'd just had enough of me and Doctor Who had to stop watching it. And the other reason I chose Frontios is because I think every Doctor Who season, or majority of them, do have a sort of forgotten story. And I think whether it's Planet of Evil or Face of Evil, they sort of come to mind in terms of the forgotten stories. And Underworld is also forgotten as well, but with good reason. But Frontios, I don't think, is rubbish at all. I think it's a solid story. Some commentators sort of say that Davison's performance in this is very much like Tom Baker, but I actually disagree with that, because Bidmead obviously wrote Castrovalva and had the idea for the Fifth Doctor in his mind when he's coming up with the, what do you call it, the character brief, as it were. So he actually knew the character better than, well, 99% better than the other writers on that series. And he actually got the mannerisms right. And Davison's performance is then sort of, when he's given really good material to, not saying he's slacking off during the rest of the time, but when he's given really good material, he really just nudges it a little bit extra. And I think in this story, he definitely, it's ramped up a little bit as well.
With regards to Peter Davison's performance, I think there are some really good bits. I mean, he reminds me more of the First Doctor in this than he does of Tom Baker.
Yeah.
Certainly, like a lot of the business, when he's got his glasses out and stuff, and he's doing a lot of stuff.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
It seems very William Hartnell to me.
And the humour's come back. Like, JNT was very anti-jokes in the first couple of years, but the subtlety on the, like, the jokes are back, but they're really not sort of full-throated season 17 sort of style, but they're really quite, subdued, and you go, and you almost miss it, really, with the subtlety. But, we'll go on to the rest of the story, but I'm keen to get, what's your overall thoughts on, first of all, how did you feel when I chose it? I'm sort of guessing by Doc's disdain already that it was a popular choice. But, what did you guys think when I mentioned that we were going to review it, and has it sort of living up to your expectations a bit?
It was one of those which there was a whole chunk of Doctor Who stories I saw for the first time about 10 years ago, which was when I was writing for the Doctor Who Appreciation Society's magazine, The Celestial Toy Room, and I was doing this running theme every month for a year called The Madman with a Telly Box, and I did the Fifth Doctor's era in a massive chunk, and there were a few stories I hadn't seen before, and I have to say that season 21 was a bit patchy for me, because obviously I grew up just basically living off scraps. It was whatever the parents bought me for Easter or Christmas, birthday, that kind of present, or whatever pocket money I had. And actually, the Fifth Doctor's stories were quite dominant, I think, in my collection in the late 90s. I had stuff like Resurrection, I had Planet of Fire, and I also had Snake Dance, which was my first classic, as it were, Doctor Who story. And I kind of don't count the TV movie, that's a little bit too far removed for me. But sort of like classic Doctor Who, Snake Dance was there. And I always wanted, as a kid watching these, I always needed an in. And the in for me was normally when there was a male companion there.
In for me?
Because it was someone who I could sort of latch onto as that sort of audience, that audience attachment. And I always really liked Turlough. And from what I'd seen of the Fifth Doctor, Tegan and Turlough, they were quite early on, even just from a few stories, my favourite Fifth Doctor TARDIS team. Because I thought the bickering had kind of gone from Tegan at that point. There weren't so many companions as there were in 19, even though actually I do like that setup. But I think Turlough's quite an interesting companion. I know, obviously, that ideas behind him never really fully bloomed. So I got to Frontios after being pleasantly surprised by The Awakening. And the thing that I noticed straight away from this, especially watching them chronologically, was just how even two or three stories in season 21 was a vast improvement on season 20. And I really liked it, actually. It's not one that I think would ever, well, actually, it didn't break into my top five Davison stories, but it's certainly in the top half for me. There are things I don't like about it.
Oh, definitely.
There are actually a couple of acting decisions from Peter Davison that I noticed the last time I watched it, and I wasn't too sure about them. But I'll come on to them after I hand the conch over to one of my fellow presenters.
I was reasonably pleased you chose it, actually, because it's not one I've seen much lately. It's not one I ever had on DVD. And recently we did the Peter Davison retrospective and couldn't find it anywhere. I managed to find it online, and it was on a website where it had been slightly slowed down and the image had been flipped.
It was like a mirror image, wasn't it?
Yeah, because obviously, I guess whoever's uploaded it, they do this to avoid the BBC's detection software.
Right.
Yes.
So were the tractators shuffling even slower? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Jesus, is this the extended cut?
Actually did have to put it on at 1.5 speed to watch it at normal pace.
You've done the crystal meth method, have you?
Yeah, but you had to, just to get it all done within 3 hours. And seeing as it's just for the retrospective, and I thought, well, this probably isn't going to be in the top five, and if it is, I don't have to say anything about it. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to stop watching. So I stopped watching it. So this was the first time I sat down and watched it for ages. Oh, I also saw an episode of it when I was in Corfu in the 90s. Sat at an English bar, eating my breakfast of cheese and ham omelette, and they had UK Gold on. And that was playing in the background. So I remember seeing the Tractators. I was sitting there eating my breakfast thinking, oh, thank God nobody knows I'm a fan of Doctor Who here.
Except when you started spitting your omelette over, everybody started saying, Tractators as bits of egg. And typical Brit. Look at him on the sauce and he's eating a, trying to line the stomach.
So I was quite curious to watch it again because my memories of it are of it being quite dour and... I'd say dull. So that was how I approached it. I watched it this afternoon, actually, and I have to say, unfortunately, I've had terrible toothache all day. So it wasn't the... that may also have slightly coloured my opinion of it.
So the Tractators are burying into the earth and your nerve is burying into your tooth cavity. Mm,
yeah. Oh,
you poor bugger. Were you watching it at 2:30? Did you start the...
Thank you.
The silence is deafening, guys. I'll just keep moving.
It's one of those that I think I didn't see probably until... I mean, I doubt I saw it until maybe... I don't know. I must have seen it on UK Gold in the early 90s. Because otherwise, there's no way I would have seen it on...
live transmission.
Because I only got the DVD when we were doing the Davison retrospective before that. So I didn't have the DVD before that. I know I never had the VHS, but I had seen it before, so I must have watched it somewhere.
So in 1984, you'd stopped watching it. So you were basically doing a mark with the Jodie Whittaker series. You just stopped watching it, yeah?
I definitely stopped watching it in 1984. No, 84, I would have been 85 and to 89. I was off at uni. And I didn't fancy going into sort of Halls Rest's television room and say, excuse me, do you mind if we switch off the sports and watch Doctor Who, please?
I put on Time Lash part one.
Yeah, so it's partly that and partly the fact that I just really, once Tom had gone, I couldn't think of Peter as anything more than Tristan from Only Fools and Horses.
That's Rodney.
Something with animals. Our Family and Other Animals, what was he called?
All Creatures Great and Small.
All Creatures Great and Small. And then it just got seemed to get silly with Colin and with...
Sylvester.
I can't even remember Sylvester being announced as being cast for it, which is how much I was out of it. And so I think I must have watched round about maybe most of Peter's first series on broadcast, but that was about it. And then I stopped because I wasn't interested. But I hope that was an armchair.
Yes, it was. Sorry.
But I thought that was a nappy giving way again.
And the one reason I'm not keen on Peter's Doctor is that he seemed the blandest of all the classic Doctors. He wasn't allowed to joke. He was mainly out of breath and just saying, oh, well, that's happened, has it? Oh, dear. And I think I was mainly probably taking that attitude with this. I think, as I said many times before, when I was watching UK Gold in the early 90s on Sunday mornings, the omnibus editions, I was mainly dropping off every few minutes to recover from whatever I'd been doing on Saturday night in London. So I don't remember it that much. And then I watched it again deliberately for the Peter Davison retrospective we did not so long ago. And I was quite taken aback by it. I really, really enjoyed it because I think he finally gets to...
do what he wants with it. He sort of worked it out, you think?
Yes.
As soon as he's quit, he goes, I think I've got this now.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He's allowed to be humorous. Hmm. But it's not particularly a slapstick story, is it? But he's allowed to be sarcastic. He's allowed to come back at the baddies.
With a bit of vigour, isn't he, really?
With a snarky remark, yes. Instead of just saying, oh, wouldn't you like to experience a finely cooked meal? Or the breath on your face? Oh, f*** off, breath on your face. Say something nasty to him. So, for instance, he says, and he's allowed to play it for laughs, which takes away one of his greatest weaknesses for me. So, for instance, he's saying stuff like, what does he say? He starts getting snarky with Plantagenet.
Yes.
Aidan.
Yeah.
When you and Sophie were thinking of boys' names, was Plantagenet ever on the list?
No, it wasn't, but we did whittle it down. Well, we whittled William down from Brazen, Range, and weirdly enough, Gravis at some point as well.
Well, he says, oh, marvellous, you're going to kill me. What a finely tuned response to the situation.
Mm.
I really enjoy that sort of thing. Particularly when he starts taking the piss out of Tegan.
Yes.
Gravis. Was he pretend she's an android or something?
Yeah. Yeah, the walk's a bit wonky in the accent, yeah.
And yeah. For once, he isn't telling off his companions. Where he is being snarky and snide throughout most of his era, it's directed towards his companions. He's being snarky at Tegan and at Adric, and for some of the time at Turlo. Not Nyssa, she's that little sort of doctor's pet, doesn't she?
I think it's a mistake of having, not a mistake, you know, having a younger doctor.
A consequence.
Yeah, and having younger companions. That antagonism naturally, because I suppose if you get a bunch of young people, don't say this the wrong way, Hayden, a bunch of young people together, yeah, there might be some consequences of that. You know, not saying that all body, you know, having a crack, but I think having somebody to let a mature head to sort of level it out, you wouldn't have that. But
that's why I hang out with you guys, because I'm fed up with that lot, you know.
Ah. And you'll notice that that Tegan and Turlo are finally suddenly made up for some reason. Because that's the thing, that them bitching at each other the companions used to get annoy me. But now they've made up to such an extent that you'll find Turlo taking a piss against the wall of the TARDIS. Tegan just strolls over to him and talks to him while he's doing it.
But that happens in a lot of men's rooms, surely, Doc. You know, when you go to a convention, surely you're having minding your own business and John Barrowman comes next to you and it's all pretty good, isn't it?
Does that mean he wasn't the first Doctor Who companion to have his knob out on the TARDIS set?
I first noticed this when we were doing the Davison retrospective. I thought, does no one ever talk about this in fandom because they've not noticed it? Was it because they thought it would be too childish? Leave it to us to do. But it just... They've got that first scene where Captain Rivier gets sucked into the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then they flick to the TARDIS. And Turlo's standing against this wall. Very close. And I think he's supposed to be putting his ear against the wall to hear the Doctor's doing behind it. But it really looks as if he's... Because unfortunately, if you're standing with your ear against the wall, you put your hand next to your ear, don't you? Against the wall. But he's actually got his hands down out of sight. He's pressed against this wall. And if when Tegan comes up and she's talking to him, at one point he sees me, he almost closes his eyes and does that sort of...
Oh, blessed relief.
As if he's been holding this one in throughout the awakening.
Well, he has been locked up a lot, hasn't he?
If you notice,
all that tea.
Just as he actually turns away from being face onto the wall, he does that, and you, ladies listening, you have to take our word for this. He does that little thing where he sort of sucks in his stomach that you do in order to pop it back in,
and then he jumps up and down, and shakes it off, and walks off.
I can't believe no one's noticed this.
So I'm sure some YouTuber will get that clip and overlay the appropriate sound effect on it. Surely. But maybe, you know, they've been at each other for so long now, it's just like introducing our dog to the cat. It's gone from swiping to sort of a sort of semi-calm coexistence. In this story, though, they've actually got the allocation of airtime between the two companions right, where
yes.
In Awakening, Turlo was sent off to purgatory in a barn somewhere. But this story, they've got equal screen time. They're both doing fairly interesting things. I mean, poor old Tegan's getting asked, you know, to make the coffee essentially on a couple of occasions. But they've got equal screen time. And again, with the resurrection, they've also got it sorted out as well. Yeah, I think they've actually got the balance really right on that one, where it's always been either one-sided. You know, it's either... Obviously, Bidmead knows is set up enough to be able to cope with it, where other writers during that time couldn't. Should we talk about the tractators?
Yes. So this is where some of my negativity comes in on the story.
Yeah, me too.
I think the story is a fairly strong one.
Hmm.
But in a way, I kind of don't think the tractators are needed. I think they work better as an idea. I mean, to see a companion so paralysed with fear at the mere sight or, you know, thought of them is kind of enough. You could keep these guys in the shadows. Because clearly the costume doesn't work. And I know this is 84, you know, so we are talking quite a while ago now. But this is a point in the show's history where they're starting to catalogue the crappy rubber monsters. Like, Murker appeared, earlier on that month when it came out? And it does damage the overall look of the story. Of course it does, because they're just not that good. I mean, like, the little skirts they seem to have that aren't touching the floor. They reminded me a little bit of, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Mighty Boosh.
Yes.
But they had there's an episode in series one with Charlie, the bubblegum monster. And they look a bit crap like that. But the thing about Charlie was that he was meant to look crap. The thing about the Tractators was that they were supposed to look menacing. And when you watch these things as an adult for the first time, you do have to kind of suspend your disbelief in a way that you wouldn't have to if you'd have seen it when you were a kid. You know, you could probably forgive it. Like, God, I forgive loads of stuff from Who that I saw as a kid. But the Tractators just aren't forgivable, I suppose. I like the idea of them. But like I said, I would have kept them in the shadows. I wouldn't have had them from the centre.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and especially when they're made in 1984, if you say look at the mutants, we're a similar insectoid creature. And yes, obviously the mutts aren't as big and bulky as what the Tractators are supposed to be. But just the build on those, they're amazing. If you want to try and do an unfair comparison between insects, I'm not going to mention the web planet though. And when you're resorting to pressing the fast forward button to give the appearance, well, the 1.5 speed button, the crystal meth option, to make them appear to walk faster than what they should.
I've not noticed that. Never did that.
Yes, if it is a scene where they're all sort of walking together, and I think that they've got crystal meth is pressing the button for the 1.5 speed, and it's obviously a video disc or something to speed it up. We had a marathon runner in the early 80s called Cliff Young, and he won this Sydney to Melbourne marathon in 1983, and essentially was a farmer who had not much training apart from shuffling around his farm. And he won this marathon. This the shuffling gait of the Tractators reminded me of Cliff Young a bit, really.
Computer, could you bring us up a picture of Charlie the bubblegum monster from Mighty Boosh, please?
There he is.
Oh, dear. They don't have moustaches, though, the Tractators, do they?
It does look like Noel Fielding, doesn't it, really?
He looks like he's eaten Noel Fielding with that moustache.
Exactly. And the worst thing about the Tractators is that they did a similar bloody monster at the end of the season with a Mester. Exactly the same. Same sort of gait, same sort of just they're waving his arms. I mean, no wonder Ricky Gervais took the piss out of it in extras.
They look quite a bit like pterodactyls, don't they?
Yeah, exactly.
As if they're wearing a sort of a cloak over their shoulders or something.
Yeah.
My problem with them is the thought that, one, all that power to bring down meteoroids from space is and enough power to not only to break up the TARDIS, but to join it together when the inside of the TARDIS must be in a different dimension anyway. Just seems too little silly, really.
But when it's amplified like the way they've done it, and I do like the bit with the you know, how they've got the excavators going through the planet to amplify the signal and everything like that, and those excavating machines. It's a shame they didn't do what they wanted to do, was sort of make it a bit out of bones and things like that, but of course the production wouldn't allow it at the time. But I like the concept of it, but yes, it's, you know, again, it's like Mondas, but, you know, they just want to pot around the universe and the planet, just getting around. But on the making of documentary about the Tractators, like Christopher H. Bidmead says that, you know, he had the thought of the woodworm and everything like that, which is fine. And he knew that it was actually too ambitious, really, for the production at the time. And that Eric Sawyer should have said something to him. And I thought, hold on, no, mate, you were there for a year and a half.
Yeah.
You know what the production limitations are. Don't blame... I know it's pretty popular to kick Eric Sawyer at every left, right and turn these days.
Oh, Eric Saywood, I love you.
But don't have a crack at that, because you know what the series was, having worked on it so closely. I mean, Terrence Dix always used to say that they're too ambitious, we haven't got any money, rip it out. Yeah, I didn't agree with that one, to be honest. I thought poor old Eric. Chris Bidmead should have had some sense too when he's doing the description of them. Don't make it so ambitious for the £10 budget that they were given.
It's not a very Chris Bidmead-y story, is it?
Obviously, he gets his TARDIS fan glaze at the end of it, where it's all being put back together and everything like that. But yeah. You're right, it doesn't involve TARDISes upon TARDISes and everything like that. It's actually quite a claustrophobic story in a sense. I was watching it. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but the Blake Seven helmets, I kept thinking, is this a sort of forgotten outpost of the Federation that's been completely forgotten? I mean, I know they didn't have much for costumes, but really, guys, you could have done something with them. I mean, Blake Seven only finished, what, 3 years earlier? Surely. Anyway, but I do like the claustrophobic feel about it. And you mentioned before, Doc, at the intro, Ron Jones, you don't really remember his work. Well, his directing style is a bit like wallpaper, to be honest. You just sort of put it on the wall and see what it sticks. But I think he does a lot better in these sort of studio-bound stories than what if you give him some money and try and film Concord and go to Amsterdam and things like that. But I think the actors actually directed a lot of themselves on this production, to be honest. I don't think Ron Jones is a particularly effective director.
What else has he done? Is it Black Orchid, Time Flight,
Arca Infinity? I mean, Vengeance on Varus is probably his pinnacle, yeah. But I don't think he directed anything after Doctor Who, did they? Really? Some of those J&T directors did one Doctor Who, or two of them, or three of them, and just didn't do work in the business again.
Oh, hang on.
Or am I wrong?
He worked as a production manager on series such as Bergerac and Secret Army.
Oh, there you go.
No, quality.
I directed episodes of Juliet Bravo.
Oh, really? I take that back. There you go. I take that back.
What about Mark? Permanent Marker. What do you think of the... I was going to say the Pterolyptals then, the Tractators.
Oh, well, they're obviously rubbish. It was brave to try and do them, but they shouldn't have done. Having said that, talking about production generally, I think the sets are really effective.
Yeah.
I think considering it's completely studio-bound, it's what they've managed to do works really well.
Mm.
So I love that outdoor set just outside the base where all the bombardment's coming in.
Mm.
And the lighting as well, I think, is pretty...
Yeah,
like, they've actually
yeah
got,
the lighting.
Yeah, they turned it down, haven't they? They've actually got it right, yeah.
Yeah, and then when they're inside, it is all dark and gloomy when they haven't got electricity. And the tunnels look great as well. And I think the designers on the documentary making of saying how pleased he was with the sort of transition from overground to underground part of the set, which was on multiple levels. And then that does look great when you've got people stood at the top there in the base looking down. And I just thought all that was good. Although I'm not sure why they gave why did they give that huge jar of acid like that sequined base? And also, why is Tegan so excited to go and get it? Like, that other woman says, oh, look, I know where there's a really big jar of acid. And Tegan's like, yeah, I'll come and get it with you.
It's, it's a camp version of the Keller machine, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Well, acid gets people excited in some countries.
Well, yes, indeed.
1990s, time for the guru. I don't know.
There was, I was quite surprised at the set because it made it look as though they must have been like Studio One or something at a television centre, because it's huge. Mm. Like the amounts of setups they have. I counted, I think it's five sets that they use in the first episode alone. And they all look pretty big and expansive. So yeah, I mean, the design work on it, apart from the Tractators, is really good.
Well, it had to be quite a big studio because the camera's such a long distance from the actors for long periods of it. Particularly the bits where they've got the masked off. What do you call them? The glass
shots.
Yeah, the glass shots and stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's one of my favourite things about this story, to be honest. The design work.
Can I bring up a couple of things that I noticed this time around that I actually found a little grating and found a little disappointing?
Which is the flooring?
When I used to have. Oh no! Actually, yes. No. Before I go on to that, I will just mention the flooring.
That's when you said something was a little grating.
Boom!
So recently, I managed to somehow obtain like 700 views on a video on Twitter of me watching the original VHS release of Revenge of the Cybermen. And you know the scene when the Fourth Doctor is in Kelman's room?
Yeah.
And he electrifies it, and they show a shot of his feet getting electrocuted, and then Tom Baker jumps up onto the bed. That floor is used again in Frontios. That's used in the crash ship.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that the one with the dots in it?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, in the research lab on this colony ship.
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
Because I thought the walls, because some of the shots had the walls there, which had like these little blue squares, and I thought they were like recycled from Horns of Nightmare sets.
So what were these two things you noticed, Hayden?
The whole cliffhanger of the TARDIS being destroyed is utterly ruined by Peter Davison's understated delivery of that line.
Yeah, like there's a little eye roll.
The TARDIS has been destroyed. He puts his hands in his pockets at the end of episode one. And that, for me, this time watching it, just thought... And the fact that for the rest of the story, they barely mention it until part four, when Tegan straws across, "Oh, Doctor, look! It's in the..." Oh, no, I won't attempt an Australian accent. I've gone Australian.
Please don't. Those trade negotiations are very delicate at the moment, mate, so please don't.
I have to send some Navy ships into the sea and haggle over the fish. And I just thought, oh, yeah, I remember the TARDIS has been destroyed. And if that's a huge plot point, which it should be, a lot more should be made of that.
Yeah, nobody seems really bothered, do they?
No.
Until episode three, I think it gets mentioned.
Towards the end of it, towards the end of the episode. And I found that really distracting this time. Maybe it's because we've had, how many years now? 16 years of New Who, where you've had shocking things happen to the TARDIS, like Father's Day when he opens the doors and nothing's there, and Jodie digging the TARDIS up, and John Sims' master nicking it in Utopia.
And that big, massive TARDIS, you know, what was that episode? Is it the name of the Doctor? That big, massive TARDIS that's sort of stuck on Trenzalore. Yeah, that one as well.
When something bad happens to the TARDIS, the Doctor is in peril. His life is in jeopardy, more so than it ever has been, because he's got no means of escape. He's got no means of returning and no means of safety. So for Peter Davison, just goes, the TARDIS has been destroyed.
Oh, yeah, it's like, do you know what? And I'd left my favourite hat on there as well.
Oh, no. And then another thing as well, it struck me, this is during that period between the King's Demons and Planet of Fire, when Chameleon's supposed to be on board, doing nothing. And nothing's mentioned. It's like, oh, no. You don't hear, like, Turlough go, "Oh, no, we've vaporised Chameleon." Give us a damn.
Maybe that's why Peter Davison responds as he does. He's like, "I know the TARDIS has been destroyed, but oh well, at least we got rid of
it." Ian Levine, the famously fastidious Ian Levine, is the continuity advisor at this point. You know, did he not say, because Chris Rage Ridmey wouldn't have known about the Chameleon character because he'd been away from the programme, but wouldn't he have said at some point, even to put a line in? So, I mean, so those two things grated with me this time round. Because I thought the jeopardy and the stakes could have been higher if that had been made more of a point in the story. And I actually think that's a bit of a failing of the story. The fact that you've got a part, you know, the TARDIS is gone. It's been blown up.
And a bit more residual debris, you know, a couple of roundels flying around on the floor. And even that pull to open sign, if you had that there sort of all charred like they did in the new series, I think would have sold it. And then, it's very understated compared to, as you said, you know, Tennant in, was it Utopia or wherever it was, where he's banging on the door saying, "Let me in, let me in. Yeah, it was like, I suppose we'll get off somehow. We've got the Federation here. I'm sure we can get off somehow. You know, but a couple of roundels would have been nice, or even a bit of a chameleon's arm flying around somewhere.
Yes, yeah.
Anybody lose this? No, we'll just keep moving through, thanks. But,
you know, in Planet of Fire, that like metallic scream of his, couldn't they just, when it blows up, have the in the background?
You have to get on board for the special edition.
And have that in the same key as the end credit music.
Oh my god.
I can see it now. It's all happening. And speaking of music, what did you think of the haunting panpipe music by Paddy Kingsland?
He's a very distinctive composer. Because as soon as I watched this, I knew it was Paddy Kingsland because it sounded so familiar to Castrovalva, to Legopolis, and obviously Hitchhikers.
Mm.
That's sort of like that whistling kind of the... I know this is Castrovalva, but the...
Oh, lovely.
And all that kind of thing going on.
And Mordred Undead, you've got... Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da
on our Time of the Rani one, which was like Phantom of the Opera turned up to 11.
What do I call Kev McCulloch? I call him the Hammer. Yeah, I always like Kingsland's music. He's very interesting. I mean, I'm not saying anything against Howl or, you know, and some of the other guys there, but him and Dominic Glynn are probably the ones who are doing the most interesting musical compositions for the program, you know, later on. But look, anything a bit of haunting panpipe music gets me, a bit of James Last potentially, you know.
I thought it was a bit repetitive. Seems the same little short refrain over and over and over again at dramatically intense moments. It didn't do much for me. Does the Doctor obsess about avoiding interference anywhere else but in the Aztecs?
Not sure, actually.
No, not really. It does seem to be a huge point in this story, doesn't it?
Because he's at the further edge of the of what's allowed, really. Yeah. Yes. I don't think so. I mean, the only thing I could think of is Underworld might mention. I mean, that would make me have to involve me going back and watching it, which I'm not going to do, despite as how much I have high regard for you guys. Is it mentioned anything in there about Time Lord's non-intervention policy in that? I can't remember. It's pretty bludgeoned, laid on thick, isn't it, really? I can't interfere. Oh, by the way, where's those bandages? Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the cast? I thought the cast was actually quite good.
The cast, I think there's some dreadful acting choices. I think that that main orderly guy, he's one of the worst actors they've had on there, isn't he? Hello, I'm the orderly. Oh, you're not going to get me to do that. Oh, I'm going to do this. Oh, help me. Don't just leave me here. Oh, no.
I'm not the new leader. Yeah. Yes, I thought, what's his name? Mr. Brazen, the guy played, was it Peter Gilmore? Was he the one from
Gilmore. Yes,
yeah, from the Eden line. He's playing it like the Eden line. And every time, like, I was watching him talking, you just see Mr. Rain just roll his eyes every time he opens his mouth. That was actually quite funny.
Yeah, every time Peter Gilmore finishes a sentence, he always has to finish it like this or something, doesn't he?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, just to reinforce the order or the vibrato in his voice, really. I don't know. But maybe I think Jeff Rawls actually quite good, but I was actually thinking maybe they should have actually got a younger actor in, hopefully not the same sort of style of the twins in The Twin Dilemma, for example, and played it a bit more like Joffrey from Game of Thrones. That'd be quite interesting. Yeah, sort of a bit of red wedding on a red planet, really.
Wait.
And what about also, is this the beginning of where all these monsters and characters start saying, I've heard about you, Doctor. Your reputation, you know, goes around the universe. I've heard about TARDISes. I've heard about this. I mean, these creatures, the furthest parts of the galaxy, I'm very surprised they would hear about the Doctor, you know. And I think this is the start of the I am known as the Doctor that sort of starts coming through, particularly in season, you know, in the next season, as opposed to I'm a traveler, I'm just a random traveler going around the galaxy. I didn't particularly like that bit.
Yeah, I spotted that. Does it happen much before this?
I don't think so, but I think it's a start of it.
Mm.
And I'm not a big fan of that, to be honest. I don't like that too much. I feel like I've bagged it too much, but on the whole, I've actually really enjoyed watching it again. It just took me back to it's a bit like that comfort blanket, isn't it, really?
Mm. Yeah.
That season, to me, is one of my favourites, apart from the ending, obviously. I actually think it's probably that season. Awakening all the way to Caves is the strongest run of inconsistent stories since season 18.
Ooh, that's...
Is that a contentious...
No, I don't think so. I'd never really thought of it like that. I think you might be right, though. I think for me, with season 18. I think from Full Circle through to Legopolis, I really like it, I have to say. With this, do you know what? I don't mind Warriors of the Deep. I just think it's a very good script, but it's just realised slightly badly.
The book's great.
I mean, awful. Yes. Yes, it is. But, yeah, I think you might be right, actually. This is kind of... would it be cruel to say this was the last... No, that would be too cruel to say this was the last hurrah, because obviously then the Sylvester McCoy era comes in, then it gets really good again. But this is probably the last time there's a consistent run of stories of a good quality up until his run, I'd say. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the last season where you know that it's not going to be cancelled the next year or the year after.
Yes, yeah.
You had this, it's just going to keep going on forever, isn't it? And I might have a chance one day of playing the 13th Doctor because it's going to keep going on, you know, and 12 months later, ba-bow.
I will have to say it was very nice of Peter Gilmore to leave his hair behind for Colin Baker to pick up at the end of The Caves of Androzani. But what I want to know is who nicked the sideburns.
Oh, yes. I think maybe Ian Marlow went and got those back.
I was pleased to see them carrying on the tradition of Turlough following closely behind Tegan when she's wearing some sort of tight clothing. Like, I think it's a bit where they're both approaching a ladder and you just see Turlough just sort of stand back slightly and push Tegan towards the ladder first. I was just, you naughty Turlough, just because she's got that skirt on.
It might be the race memory coming back. That's a bit, I don't know. The whole race memory thing to me is a bit, really? I don't know. I know Doctor Who sometimes is slightly unbelievable. That's a bit, taken a little bit too far.
Yeah.
I mean, the acting convincing. Yeah, it's just like, he's remembering something that he had no real idea of. It's all trapped in, yeah.
Yeah, I think it works for Quatermass in the Pit, but probably not so much here.
No. But on the whole, though, I really enjoyed watching it again. And I think it's a forgotten Davison, and if you haven't, you know, it does get overlooked with all the others, you know, it's a Snake Dance and certainly Caves. But it was nice to watch a bit of 80s Doctor Who and take it back, you know, happy times and places, as it were. Can I mention that podcast? That's actually quite good. I don't mind that one. What about you, Doc? What do you think?
It was okay, but only in the, really in the sense that it was the best of, for me, of a bad bunch, being the Fifth Doctor's era. So I could have done without a lot of all the stomping around and threatening to arrest people all the time. Bored me to tears, that. It's a bit like the security chief in Enemy of the World.
Oh, yeah.
Who played very much the same character, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, you're guilty of treason. I'm going to arrest you. Oh, shut up. And I must admit, I do get bored with the Doctor turns up and they immediately assume he's a spy. Ever since Doctor Who started, that becomes a bit too much of it almost becomes a relief when they just accept him as a friend straight off. So, Mark, you suggested this story. Mark's out of 10.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
I'd give it a 7.
Hayden?
Snap.
Permanent marker?
6.
I'd give it a...
Here we go.
I'd give it a 7.
Yay! Yeah. There you go. Were you glad I chose it, guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this was interesting.
Yeah, yes, because I haven't seen it properly for quite a long time.
It's a good episode to review for the podcast because it's a good story, but it's got its flaws, which means that you can kind of explore that more.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was very grateful that you chose this instead of Fear Her, where it just would have been... I would have poured the entire bottle of Baileys into my hot chocolate before we started if it had been Fear Her.
Look, I did make it very clear. I was happy to appear on your podcast, but I will not be reviewing a new Who episode story. Let's just keep it nice and light.
So, Mark, you've also brought along for us an exhibit for the Whoseum, haven't you?
Yes.
Computer, could you open the blast doors to the exhibition hall, please? Thank you. Thank you. Mark, what have you brought along for us?
Yes, now look, I feel a bit greedy, guys, I'll be honest with you, because usually it's either a review or an item for the Hooseum. But apart from looking at my Clack book, I actually also dive back into my David Banks Cyberman book.
Oh, deep lore.
Deep lore. Last time I submitted my entire DWB collection, which, you know, we've been using on our podcast to read out letters and articles and things like that since, I don't know, 2014.
That's a novel idea.
It's very good, actually. It's very interesting. So today I'm donating my copy of the 1988 David Banks Cyberman book.
Excellent.
Excellent.
That's strange, because when you carried in that metal mask, I assumed it was... No, we won't be including that, don't worry.
That's the one he's going to wear in...
Oh, I don't want to be including that either.
You guys are no fun.
No, I must admit, I was aware of this, but I never encountered it before.
When this book came out, obviously it was tying into the transmission of Silver Nemesis. And at the time, the Peter Haining books were sort of seen as the go-to guides in terms of Doctor Who lore and history and everything like that, where this was essentially a fan production, but done with the highest detail, some really good behind-the-scenes anecdotes and some rare photos. But also, this is a sort of, I suppose, the first example of somebody trying to tie in all the continuity around the Cyberman's appearance in the program. And, oh yeah, it's so done delicately, not the way Big Finish do now, where they basically gave a big kipper and just slap you around the face and they're trying to shoehorn their continuity into things. I just picked it up a couple of weeks ago and just started reading it, and I thought, this is actually a really, really good book. You know, really well made. And I was lucky enough to get the hardback edition. And I've had it since that time. Cost a pretty penny getting it shipped over to Australia. Some things don't change. But yeah, it's a really... and there's also a storyline there for Genesis of the Cybermen, which is by Jerry Davis, which was supposed to be getting made. I think was sort of potentially being earmarked for the Colin Baker era. And thankfully it wasn't. Actually, I'm surprised Big Finish haven't done that one. I'm not being facetious here, but I'm actually surprised they haven't sort of done that as part of their... Lost Stories. But there you go. But so,
which
yeah,
one?
The Genesis of the Cybermen.
Oh, right.
It's a storyline they've put into the book with some lovely illustrations in there, actually. Some really great illustrations as well. But yeah, I'm surprised they haven't done that. But just the way David Banks, obviously, you know, he took that, his job, he took it a little bit too far in terms of the love for it. However, it paid dividends for us because he just was able to sort of massage all that continuity and timelines into a way which is A, interesting, and there wasn't any backlash at the time around what he was doing in terms of some of the, you know, the suppositions he was putting forward, you know, like Planet 14 and things like that. Yeah, it was actually really well done, beautifully tied together. So that's a book I'd like to donate to the Hooseum, if I may. I've actually met somebody who saw David Banks do the ultimate adventure.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was at a party maybe 2-3 years ago, and my friend introduced me to this lady and goes, and this is the only person I know who saw David Banks doing the Ultimate Adventure production. So I had a bit of a chat with her. So I know people who've seen Pertwee, Colin Baker, and now David Banks. So there you go. That's my claim to fame there. So, yes. I think he's still quite lean now, actually.
You know, yeah, he is.
Quite a thin man. But,
we saw him a couple of years ago, didn't we?
Yes.
Lovely guy.
Has also the artwork been done by Andrew Skilleter?
Yes, yes, it was published through Who Dares. I think, right. I can't remember if it was a big sort of initial launch into the self-publishing world as well. So it was a first of many, really. But yeah, and it just sort of, you know, you sort of had the W.H. Allen books, which, you know, were good at the time. I mean, Celebration definitely for me is, you know, the highlight, and it's close to my heart. But this was like, oh, hold on, the fans were taken over here. And they can put a product that actually surpasses in some way what the official tomes are doing. And it's a shame they never, because I know House, Amazon, Walker were wanted to do a Dalek book, but then Terry Nation went and did the other one, which was pretty to be perfectly honest with you. It would have been nice to have had that sort of Cybermen and Dalek book next to each other, well written, but alas, it wasn't to be.
I think they describe it as an illustrated mythology of the Cybermen, don't they? Which is actually is fairly accurate. There's a ton, I think it's on page 34, there's this colour photo of a Cyberman with snow all over it, and I can't work out whether it's supposed to be a scene from Tombs or a Christmas card.
I think it's called artist interpretation.
the only thing that got me really was there's quite a few quite elaborate colour paintings, but they didn't actually tell you what they're talking about. There's one that looks like a dodo in space that's caught something in its claw. I haven't the first idea what it's about.
It's a cyber dodo.
Yeah, is it the Iron Dodo?
It's the next evolution of Cybermats. You know, it's yeah, they've taken the goodies episode and Wheel and Space and merged them together.
So that's what happened to her after the War Machines.
Boom, yes, syphilis be damned. She became a cyber dodo.
I think it's very brave of him to have attempted a timeline of all the various, the proliferation of where all the various timelines of Cybermen stories come from. And it's full of behind the scenes and promotional photos I've never seen before.
Doesn't it put Revenge of the Cybermen as like the latest chronologically told story? Because they're supposed to be the last race of Cybermen in that story. I always found that interesting. And the first time I ever saw in a book that maybe the things that were happening on screen weren't, well, were more timey-wimey than it looked as though they were. So, yeah, it's interesting.
And then David then did the, he did some audio readings of those, of the books as well, in terms of narrating the mythology and everything like that. And he did, I think he did about two or three tapes of them. And I used to listen to them at night just because they had such a, you know, dulcet tones. And he used to, you know, listen to 5-10 minutes of it and then sort of drift off to sleep, a bit like what your mum does, Doc, when listening to the you three guys talking. I can't listen to our podcast while I'm asleep because I'll be waking up every 3 minutes in cold sweats and thumping desk noises and my wonderful jokes. But, yeah, if you can find those tapes, on, and I think they might have been, you know, distributed around somewhere, have a listen to them and, yeah, put them on. They're quite relaxing, actually.
Tapes of who doing what again?
David Banks was actually, he's just doing an audiobook version of the Cybermen timelines.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, so he had like Origin, something else and something else, sort of had the three distinct sort of historical segments he worked on and just put them out as audiobooks. So you hear the history of Mondas and things like that. And then obviously, again, it goes into the stories and the order he put together. Yeah, they're really good, actually. And, like, there's this bare minimum sound effects on it, bare minimum music, but it's just the way he tells it, and the text is really interesting.
Origins of the Cybermen. 15 billion years ago, the universe was born. It started with a bang. A single point had once contained everything. Suddenly, it exploded. Matter spread outwards, filling the void evenly and thinly. Space-time began.
I tried listening to that Return of the Cybermen Big Finish thing, and it's just so... And maybe it's just because I'm getting older and just can't handle a lot of loud noise these days. I just found it really overblown, all the sound effects happening left, right and centre. I just need less is more these days. But, it's a nice contrast to sort of that, as I said, getting the old dead kipper and slap it in your face sort of audio production that others do.
Is it kind of like a cyber shipping forecast?
We have excellent weather.
Yeah. Dogger, excellent.
Well, we should be delighted to add that to the museum's archives. Oh, sorry, archives.
Boom, well done.
Right then, have we covered most of what we want to talk about? Right, in that case, look, who's coming to say farewell to us? It's Uncle Terence. Hello, Uncle Terence, how are things?
Not so bad, Doc. No, not so bad. I seem to have had a 6 weeks annual leave at exactly the same time that Hayden's had a son and been on paternity leave. I mean, you can make it up. I mean, we've never really been seen in the same room together. I've never even met him. So, it's good to come back. Actually, where's Hayden gone? Where's he got to?
He's down by the riverside, burying all the podcasting bodies. Have you any advice on that front, Uncle Terence?
Well, if he's going to do that, then he shouldn't dump the bodies in the river.
Uncle Terence, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
Shit, we'd all better run!
So, Mark, nice to see you. Give our regards to Rob, won't you?
I will, absolutely.
And to Aussie podcasters everywhere.
Absolutely.
And in the meantime, I will just say to everyone, don't forget to put your cocks back, listeners. Goodbye.
Bye bye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.